Welcome to a special Aloud podcast honoring John Updike, one of America's great writers who passed away recently at the age of 76. Novelist Laurie Moore wrote, "Mr. Updike's novels wove an explicit and teeming tapestry of male and female appetites. He noticed astutely, precisely, unnervingly. His stories, some of the best ever written by anyone, were jewels of existential comedy, domestic anguish, and restraint." John Updike received the 1999 Los Angeles Public Library Literary Award. This podcast is excerpted from his acceptance speech. Rest in peace, John Updike.
Thank you, Susan, and thank you all, friends of the Los Angeles Public Library, for making so generous an award available to humble wordsmiths like me. I told the docent that now that she'd given the tour, she didn't have to read the second half of the book. But she swore she was going to stick with it, and you have to admire that kind of pluck. I'm sort of scared of this prize. The base is not connected to the... I learned two things in the last 24 hours. One, libraries no longer issue separate children's cards as they did when I was a child. One card fits all and entitles, Sue Kent assures me, it's a possessor to all the books in the place. Secondly, I heard from the lips of my fellow awardee, Gary Ross, that the people in his brilliant and beautiful movie, Pleasantville, turn from dreary gray to sparkling color, not only, as many viewers think, after acts of sex, but also after the act of reading. Both bring roses to their cheeks. An affinity, even confusion, between sex and knowledge lies, of course, near the heart of the Judeo-Christian tradition, one of whose primal narratives tells of a man and woman, Adam and Eve, who, after eating of the apple of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, suddenly know that they are naked. Quote, "Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked." Of all the animals, only man knows that he is naked and makes clothes. Carnal knowledge is a form of knowledge. How many of us, as adolescent library users, found somewhere in the books we borrowed an exciting glimpse of the carnal secrets that bring Pleasantville out of its tranquil monochrome into the disturbing riot of rainbow? Of course, some limits to the riot must be set by librarians or their boards. But in general, the splendor of a library, from this grand multimedia edifice to the humblest cowtown single room of shelves, is that it sets us free to roam in unregulated and even haphazard exploration of the fields of knowledge, to read and borrow where we will, and bit by bit advance our self-education, which is to some extent our self-creation. I would like to share with you five poems that bear on the questions of reading and writing, of the mind's growth, and why we preserve in structures as splendid as this and the Getty Museum, where my wife Martha and I, as you heard, spent much of today, why we build such large and expensive edifices to house the art of the past. The first and longest poem is about growth and appropriate to this great fruit-growing state. It is called "A Pear Like a Potato." It's based upon a pear that I once knew, grown by accident on my own modest acreage. "A Pear Like a Potato." Was it worms having once bitten and then wilted away, or some canker known only to nurserymen? Whatever the reason, the pear fresh plucked from my tree where it leans and struggles in the garden's dappled corner is a heavy dwarf head whose faceless face puckers and frowns around a multitude of old problems, its furrowed brow and evil squint and pursy mouth and pinched-in reptilian ear, re-scrambling feature for feature as I rotate this weight in my hand, this friendly knot of fruit flesh, this pear like a potato. It wanted to grow, and it did. It had a shape in mind, and if that shape in transit was waylaid by scars, by cells that turned too obdurate to join in with the general swelling and stalled instead, leaving dents between bulges like quilt buttons, well, it kept on going and rests here in my hand, ripe and ready, sun-warmed, to be eaten. Not bad. The teeth must pick their spots between the potato eyes. Sun's warmth mingles sweetly with mine. Our brains are like this, no doubt, having swelled in spite of traumas, of languages we never learned, of grudges never set aside but grown around, like parasites that died but forever snapped, the rhythm whereby cell links up to cell to make up beauty's smoothness. Plato's was a manner of speaking. Perfection's an idea there at the start that the body and soul make a run at, and falling short, fill the world instead with the lopsided jumble that is the congregation of the failed, yet not uncheerful, like this poor pear that never would do at the supermarket, bubble-wrapped with symmetrical brothers, but has given me a snack, a nibble here and there on my own land, here in the sun of a somewhat cloudy morning. That's about, as I said, growth and how we're all, to some extent, pears like potatoes. I haven't written much about the process of writing. It's really kind of immodest, and there's a tendency for some writers to glamorize the trade, which is really a trade much like any other. You try to envision a product, and then having envisioned it, you try to make it and keep regular hours. But I did once, while writing a book called Rabbit Redux in 1969, it would have been in my weariness with my sense of captivity inside this book that I thought would never get finished, I did write this poem, which gives you some slight insight, if you wanted it, into the mind of a novelist writing. It's called Marching Through a Novel. Each morning my characters greet me with misty faces, willing, though chilled, to muster for another day's progress through the dazzling quicksand, the marsh of blank paper. With instant obedience, they change clothes and mannerisms, drop a speech impediment, develop a motive backwards to suit the deed that's done. They extend skeletal arms for the handcuffs of contrivance, slog through docilely maneuvers of coincidence, look toward me hopefully, their general and quartermaster, for a clearer face, a bigger heart. I do what I can for them, but it is not enough. Forward is my order. Though their bandages unravel, and some have no backbones, and some turn traitor like heads with two faces, and some fall forgotten in the trenchwork of loose threads, poor puffs of cartoon flack. Forward. Believe me, I love them, though I march them to finish them off. This is a piece of light verse that commemorates a cultural moment long gone, and most of you are too young to remember, but somewhere in the late 50s, early 60s, a certain cultural tide began to turn as the 50s became the 60s. The gray and white 50s became the colorful 60s. And there were some writers around who shared little. This tilt seemed to come from west to east. It seemed to come from the West Coast. And I think a number of the, at least two of the three writers I mentioned in this poem were West Coast writers. Kenneth's, it's called. That's plural for the name, Kenneth. Rexroth and Patchen and Fearing. Their mothers perhaps could distinguish their sons from the others, but I am unable. My inner eye pictures a three-bodied son lover issuing strictures, berating Tom Elliot, translating Tanka, imbibing espresso and sneering at Sanka. Six arms, 30 fingers, all writing abundantly what pops into heads, each named Kenneth redundantly. You don't have to commit yourself to this exhausting program of applauding each poem. Though I enjoy it, and it gives me time to turn the page. The fourth poem is also about an affinity, a fancied affinity between authors. It's called, written in the same era, I think, when I was much younger, and indeed the world was somewhat younger, and the world of print smattered slightly more than it does now. Agatha Christie and Beatrix Potter. Many-volumed authoresses, in capacious country dresses, full of cheerful art and nearly perfect craft, we love you dearly. You know the hedgerow, stile and barrow, have sniffed the cabbage, leek and marrow, have heard the prim postmistress snicker, and spied out murder in the vicar. You've drawn the berry-beaded brambles where Mrs. Tiggywinkle rambles and mapped the attics in the village where mice plot alibis and pillage. Lord love you both, for in these places you give us cozy scares and chases that end with innocence acquitted, except for Cottontail, who did it. And lastly, a poem that tries to meditate upon why we love the great artists of the past so much. Even as heaven retreats, they continue to hover in the midair as angels, as messengers from some better, more permanent place. The poem is called The Angels, and you'll notice that I tried to describe each art in terms of the other somehow. The angels. They are above us all the time. The good gentlemen, Mozart and Bach, Scarlatti and Handel and Brahms, lavishing measures of light down upon us, telling us over and over there is a realm above this plane of silent compromise. They are around us everywhere, the old seers, Matisse and Vermeer, Cézanne and Pierrot, greeting us echoing in subway tunnels, springing like winter flowers from postcards, scotch-taped to white kitchen walls, waiting larger than life in shadowy galleries to whisper that edges of color lie all about us, as innocent as grass. They are behind us, beneath us, the abysmal books, Shakespeare and Tolstoy, the Bible and Proust and Cervantes, burning in memory like leaky furnace doors, mine pits of honesty from which we escaped with dilated suspicions. Love us, dead thrones, sing us to sleep, awaken our eyes, comfort with terror our mortal afternoons. Thank you very much for your silence, for the award.